Hello everyone and welcome to the Institute of Leadership and Management's weekly news roundup podcast, where I, Rod Jones, content manager, and Kate Cooper, head of research policy and standards at the Institute, take a critical look at what's been happening in the world of leadership and management up to the 7th of September 2020. Hello Kate.
Hello Rod.
Our first story, Kate, asks if anti-home working press coverage has gone too far. A flood of censorious newspaper coverage has stigmatised home working as a collective sickness that is slowing down the UK's recovery from the coronavirus crisis, according to Guardian writer Hetty O'Brien. She cites a recent Telegraph article stating that workers remaining at home will be more vulnerable to redundancy, and an article in the Daily Mail that reprimanded office workers for boasting smugly about their exciting new work-life balance and the amount of money they are saving on their railway season tickets, as if these were morally reprehensible acts. She writes, "Beneath this scolding is a message directed at those who aren't complying with the old status quo, where commuting every day involves not just buying a sandwich or a coffee from Pret, but helping to prop up an entire system." However, she notes, despite the media paranoia over home working, many managers don't really seem to care that people aren't back in the office. Kate, does the hostile stance to home working that has emerged from certain quarters of the press risk undermining support for flexible working?
Well, to some extent it does, and I think this idea that it's morally reprehensible to not want to commute, to not want to buy sandwiches in Pret a Manger and other chains, or to not travel on crowded trains, has to be challenged, because as we know from our own research, many people feel they are more productive at home. Now, of course, that varies depending essentially on where you are in your career and also your domestic circumstances, access to good Wi-Fi, dedicated workspace, etc. But like so many situations, the decision isn't an evidence-based one. It's based on the feelings of individuals or the personal agendas that people are trying to push. And what really stands out to me here is a phenomenon we're so familiar with, and we have workshops on it and we talk about it all the time, is resistance to change. People want the cities to be the same. And in actual fact, cities as we know them are a relatively modern invention. Working away from home is a post-industrial phenomenon. So let's embrace the changes that have been forced about us. Let's think about what we want from our cities of the future. And it might well be they become much more residential, more providers of hospitality suited to the local area, and just different.
Okay, thank you, Kate. Well, our next story actually builds on what you have just said. It's a story in Insight that a large majority of people want to continue some form of flexible working. This is a report by academics at Cardiff University and the University of Southampton, and they present the first analysis of employee survey data focusing on home working. According to the report, home working in the UK before and during the 2020 lockdown, remote working has rocketed since the start of lockdown, rising from 6% of employees before the pandemic to 43% in April this year. The results also indicate productivity among the majority of those working from home during lockdown remained stable or even improved compared to 6 months before. The results of the survey suggest that 88% of employees who worked at home during lockdown would like to continue working at home in some capacity, with around one in two employees wanting to work at home often or all of the time. Kate, what can leaders learn from this survey?
Well, as you know, we've been campaigning for a long time for more flexible working, including the opportunity to work at home, because we know without this study from Cardiff and Southampton that there are so many benefits to having that greater control over your working day and being able to flex the working day indeed to deliver better work-life balance. But the productivity findings, of course, are always interesting. Now, the question I have about this is, how sustainable is it that you never actually are in the same physical location as your co-workers? Many people do manage that, but I think things will be lost. The informal communication, the building of relationships, the bonhomie, really, that comes from being with colleagues, enjoying working together. But that's something to watch. It certainly isn't something that we think, we definitely know that creativity and innovation is lost. We don't know that, and it certainly doesn't look like that's the case. So let's continue with flexible working that is truly flexible and works for the people who are actually doing the work.
Thank you, Kate. Our next story continues the theme of change and perhaps pushes it a little further. It asks if the UK public sector should move to a four-day week. Job creation, a productivity boost, and improvements in staff mental well-being would be the primary benefits of moving the UK public sector to a four-day week, according to Future Work Specialists Autonomy. They suggest that a 32-hour working week in the public sector would benefit those regions that have been worst hit by unemployment and deprived public services during the austerity decade and the COVID crisis, and that in areas with lower public sector employment, procurement based on select criteria could be utilised to encourage private sector contractors to adopt shorter working weeks as part of working agreements. Autonomy Director of Research Will Strong said the time has come for a four-day working week and the public sector should act as the pioneer for it, both as employer and a procurer of services. To help tackle the unemployment crisis we are facing this winter, a four-day week is the best option for sharing work more equally across the economy and creating much needed new jobs. Kate, is Autonomy's vision feasible and workable? And should it happen?
Well, we do know that many companies have adopted a four-day week and are reporting that it's incredibly successful. There's no loss of productivity. In fact, they argue that productivity increases, and the people who work there absolutely love the three-day weekend, as it were. We do know that it doesn't suit every business model. But what we have to remember about a four-day working week in this context, that it's serving bigger goals. There's a bigger picture here. That if we are expecting higher levels of unemployment, then to share employment seems to make sense. But I suppose my concern about this would be that if it's only going to happen in some jobs and maybe lower paid jobs, well, then the people who are being given a four-day week might well use that or have to use that increased leisure time to take on additional work. So the work-life balance benefits won't be realised. But in countries where they have experimented with different ways of doing, I think particularly of Finland, and looked at the benefits to society rather than the business case at an organisational level, there are benefits that experienced across society, such as a positive effect on mental health. So by using a four-day week to solve one problem, we might also reduce demand on our national health. We might also find that people with the increased wages from being able to take part of in the four-day week, because it's created jobs for them, and they're obviously buying more in their local economies. It will be difficult to track the benefits. And while they might start as a social argument, as being said here by Autonomy, I think it then becomes a strong business case as well.
Thank you, Kate. Our final story looks at the Women in 2020 survey by Catherine Solomon in the United States that challenges the idea that women are blocked by men from top roles in the organisation. The survey suggests instead that few women at middle management level have career aspirations to be senior leaders. The majority of women in the 35 to 44 age demographic say they have reached their career goals and do not wish to advance further because higher job titles and compensation are secondary to having personal time to care for family and overall work-life balance. Survey data also found that upper-level management women and women in the 45 to 55 demographic, who actually seem well positioned for further advancement, also largely say they have reached their career goals and don't want to devote more hours to work or invite more stress. Only a small percentage of women say they are eager to climb as high as possible in their careers and have no concerns about balancing work and family. Kate, what can leaders do to ensure women are not forced to choose between their career or their family and lifestyle?
Do you know, there's something depressingly old fashioned about the words that are even used, and it makes me question what sort of survey was conducted, what were the survey questions, what were the interview questions that were making women in this case say that they were having to choose, because an awful lot of men like spending more time with their family, find work-life balance is important. And the assumption that the more senior you are in an organisation, the more hours you have to work and the more stressed you are, doesn't necessarily have to be the case in organisations that take work-life balance for the whole organisation seriously. So there's dated assumptions here, I think, and any conclusion that's reached that saying, oh, women are happy because they earn less and they have less responsibility has to be challenged, because it's almost blaming the women for their lack of advancement and not looking at what's the organisation do to enable the best talent to be able to combine senior jobs with meaningful home lives.
Thank you very much, Kate. And that concludes this week's episode. Before we leave, is there anything that you'd like to tell us that is happening in the Institute?
Well, the most exciting news for us, of course, is we have a new CEO. We have John Mark Williams, who's joined us from the Agile Consortium. And we are so looking forward to working with John.
A warm welcome indeed to John Williams, who I believe will be joining Kate on the podcast very soon. And we look forward to that. Listeners can find further topical content in the news and views sections on the Institute's website. And thank you once again, Kate, for your insights on these stories.
Thank you, Rod.